but extremely important time. And just kind of wonderful to look at what God did during that war. And just as a reminder, what that was 30 years after we won our independence against Great Britain. We were once again at war with Great Britain. Their intention was, now we know, 200 years later, their intention was to divide and conquer the United States and take back the United States and to make it a part of the Great Britain. And with few exceptions, when the war started in 1812, 1813, and even most of 1814, the United States lost, I said with few exceptions, lost almost all its battles that it fought. And the British strategy was, just so we understand what happened, was they were going to have these skirmishes, and they did for a couple of years, and then they were going to attack Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States, burn it to the ground, capture the lawmakers, capture the president, and they did that. They attacked Washington, D.C., and they burnt it to the ground. They were not able to capture the lawmakers and the president. The president barely escaped. Actually, he was never again able to live in Washington as they rebuilt Washington. It wasn't until James Monroe became president that he could move back into the Capitol. But they weren't able to capture the lawmakers and the president because God sent a storm, an unbelievable windstorm, that put the fires out for the most part and killed many of the British soldiers, a wind and hail storm. In fact, one of the British historians says that the storm killed more soldiers, British soldiers, than the Americans did in the battle. And so quite a horrific thing for the British Army. After that, a few weeks later, Britain then decided they would attack the nation's second largest city, which was Baltimore, just north of Washington, and they had to attack and destroy Fort McHenry, which protected the city of Baltimore. And that story is, of course, the story of the Star Spangled Banner, and God miraculously saved that fort and the city of Baltimore. And after that battle, this is the late summer of 1814, Britain decided that they would agree initially to cease hostilities. And within a few weeks, British and American negotiators met in Europe, and they began to draw up the peace treaty that would end this war. That is at least what it looked like on the outside. Now we know, years later, that Britain had no intention of ending the war. In fact, at the moment that the negotiators were working in Belgium, Britain was sailing 10,000 of its troops down the East Coast. They were going to sail around Florida and invade New Orleans. This was the third part of the strategy. And they were going to invade New Orleans and capture the Louisiana Purchase that the United States had just recently purchased, and then divide and conquer the United States from the South. And they were in the process of sailing those 10,000 troops down to New Orleans. These were crack British soldiers. These soldiers had just defeated Napoleon in Europe. This was not a ragtag army. These were some of the finest soldiers in the world. They stopped in Jamaica, and they picked up 5,000 more battle-hardened soldiers. And this great armada of 15,000 troops then sailed to New Orleans to finish off the Americans, take the southern part of America, and split the nation in two. Now we shift to a man that we have not looked at in history, but we'll talk about him this morning. But General Andrew Jackson was, by this time, already Tennessee's most famous citizen. He, by the age of 46, had already served in Congress. He had been a U.S. senator. He was kind of in retirement after this, and he was appointed to be major general in order to stop this southern and protect this southern region of the United States. He got wind of this British armada sailing around Florida, and he really a kind of a true American hero. He had been shot just a couple weeks before this twice from behind in a quarrel, and almost died, almost bled to death, miraculously survived. And he came off his sickbed and took 1,000 soldiers that he could put together from Kentucky and Tennessee, just a bunch of good old boys, sharpshooters, and and moved as quickly as they could to New Orleans when he heard of the advancing British army. When he got there, he tried to rally the people of New Orleans to join him in this battle that was about to happen. Well, New Orleans is primarily occupied by French at that time, and the French looked down on Americans as crude and uncivilized and didn't really want to help. He was able to put together kind of a ragtag army of pirates and slaves and Indians and these backwoods frontiersmen that he had gotten in Kentucky and Tennessee. And this group would take on the battle-hardened soldiers of the British Empire. So we have an army of about 4,500 Americans coming against 15,000 British soldiers. And this is what the Americans looked at, and this is what they had to defend New Orleans and the country. Now, because of delay and hesitation, the British Navy was not able to attack quickly, and it gave time for Jackson to build to dig trenches and to pile up the mud and the rocks in about 8-foot embankments that they could use to stop the British if they got that far, and also to shoot over onto the British Army. That's important because of what will happen. But the British assumed that as soon as Jackson's embarrassingly undisciplined army would see them, they would turn and run, and it would be just a rout by the British soldiers. On Sunday morning, January 8, 1815, the British invasion began, and a heavy fog hung over the battlefield as these 15,000 troops lined up and marched towards those embankments. The fog completely concealed the redcoats as they quietly walked across the fields, again stretched over a mile. And the muskets at that time, the guns that the Americans had, were really not accurate until you got about 300 yards out. And so they knew that, and they're on top of these ramparts watching, squinting in the fog, trying to see if the British, where they are, because they couldn't fire on them with any accuracy until the British were right in front of them. Then the miracle happened, and out of nowhere, a stiff breeze rose up and blew the fog away just immediately and exposed the massive army for the first time. God had brought this sudden gust of wind and revealed the army at the exact right moment, and Jackson was ready. And his troops took turns shooting and reloading while another line of men would rise up and shoot. Waves of lead sliced through the British troops over and over again. A British veteran who survived, he said this later. He said, "Never before had British veterans quailed, but it would be silly to deny that they did not so now. The leaden torrent no man on earth could face. I had seen battlefields in Spain and in the East, but nowhere such a scene as this." And by 8 o'clock in the morning, just 30 minutes after the battle began, the fighting was over. What was left of the British Army had retreated back to the sea and abandoned the battlefield. In just 30 minutes, God had brought a miracle and allowed the Americans to win an overwhelming victory and end the War of 1812. The official tally of the dead that Jackson reported back to the Secretary of War was miraculous. He reported back 7 killed and 6 wounded. That's all the Americans lost. The British reported over 2,000 dead. President James Madison proclaimed, "History records no example of so glorious a victory obtained with so little bloodshed on the part of the victorious." And I would say to us, as a modern audience, a modern world, it's impossible for us to understand what this victory meant to contemporary Americans. Never again would they feel that they had to prove themselves to the world that this country, this unique experiment in liberty and constitutional government, that was called America. America changed after this. Never again would we fight Britain, ever again. They would become actually our greatest ally, as it turns out. On March 4th, 1815, President Madison proclaimed a day of national thanksgiving, and you see it here. And one of the things he says in this proclamation that is not on the screen, it says, "No people ought to feel greater obligations to celebrate the goodness of the great disposer of events and the destiny of nations and the people of the United States. To the same divine author of every good and perfect gift, we are indebted for all those privileges and advantages, religious as well as civil, which are so richly enjoyed in this favored land, especially for the restoration of the blessing of peace. And what a great victory. What a fun part of history to study as God moved very clearly three times in just a matter of months to destroy this great army that had invaded us. And I think, you know, I always try to think of something that we can get from this, but I think it's good to encourage ourselves into what God has done on our behalf, on behalf of our nation and on behalf of our personal lives. Christians can become discouraged and disheartened by the state of our country, and our country is in a mess. There's no question. But I don't believe that God is finished with our nation yet. And if we look back at history, we can see times when people thought God was finished, that we were done. And God came in because of the prayers of his people and saved America over and over again. And I think we should remember that and be encouraged by that.